This is Anne Morin, and that's way too close. Mm-hmm. And this is the interview with Kim Nguyen. And Kim, I need for you to start by just saying, I am Kim Nguyen. And if you would do that a couple times.
I am Kim Nguyen.
Wait, do it again.
I am Kim Nguyen.
A little bit louder.
I am Kim Nguyen.
That's perfect. Okay. And so you're going to say, I'm Kim Nguyen, and I'm originally from blah blah, and then just go from there.
Yeah. I'm Kim Nguyen, and I'm originally from Saigon, Vietnam.
And tell me a little bit about your family, your school, where you grew up.
I came from Saigon originally, from a family of six other siblings, three brothers, three sisters, and I attended a Catholic high school.
And what did your mom and dad do? And
my father was a manager for a big post office in Saigon, and my mom was a homemaker.
And what was school like for you?
Catholic schools are usually very strict. We had the nuns running all the discipline, making sure that kids attend school and do what they're supposed to do. And the teachers are also very strict. And we were expected to be good students, not skipping, doing well, and passing all the tests in order to pass onto the next grade.
Would you say your childhood was happy?
Yes, my childhood was very happy.
How? Tell us about it.
My father was a very dedicated father. He always made sure that we got what we needed, and he would never eat a meal before all of us were home. And in Vietnam, we have a lunchtime between 12 and 2:30, so he always picked us up from school, bring us home for lunch, and then we took a nap, and then he takes us back to school. So he was a very dedicated father.
And your mom?
My mom was strictly a homemaker, and she felt her role was to serve the husband and the children. So she still does that now. She had kids within a 20-year span, and the youngest one is 20 years younger, and the oldest one is 20 years older, and all her life was dedicated to serving the kids, and now the grandkids.
Where does she live now?
She lives with me and my son, so it's a three-generation home.
How did you end up in Vietnam in the United States the first time, Kim?
I was an exchange student, American Field Service exchange student, in 1971. And I was chosen among many students who there were a lot of students who wanted to go to the United States. So you had to go through a lot of tests or interviews, and then you pass. And I was one of the 14 students. Each year, American Field Service chooses about 10 to 15 students to go abroad. So it's a cultural exchange student program.
What year was this?
1971.
So the war was going on in Vietnam.
The war was going on in Vietnam, and I remember coming to Vancouver, Washington, and all the students I went to school with at Evergreen High School, they all asked me about the war in Vietnam and whether I was, you know, being impacted by it and what it was like to grow up in Vietnam and whether I saw any communists and whether I saw the GIs over there, and they were totally curious.
And what did you tell them? Had you experienced all those things?
Because we grew up in Saigon, which is a very, very large city, and things were pretty normal because the war happened all around us in the far countryside. So we really didn't experience the direct impact. All we experienced was just some once in a while, you know, maybe the roads are not safe. So you have to, the supplies to fruit and vegetables will stop. So you have to pay higher prices. Once in a while, you get a terrorist attack into a theater, a grenade thrown here and there, or a planted bomb in a car. But it was, people just move on. Just like you live with, you know, a country that has earthquakes, and you just live your life as normally as possible.
Interesting. So you came to, I'm going to have to move this. This is, maybe you could turn this way a little bit, Kim. No, turn your chair, because I want you to be comfortable. But I can't keep holding this way. It's breaking my
arm. I can hold it. I can hold it for you.
Well, no, they want me to do it.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, that's going to be much better, I think. Let's see if I can get this over here.
I was looking at your landscape. It's beautiful.
Hmm?
Landscape.
Isn't that beautiful? Yeah. You... Let's see, where is that? Oh, you talked about how luck was a really important part of your life. Can you explain that as far as you're coming here the first time?
Well, I think the luck happens when I was basically, when I was chosen as an exchange student, I was on a waiting list because they were looking for a host family. And my American host family, who lived in Vancouver at that time, was going to accept a girl from Thailand. So at that time, they were hoping to get that girl because their daughter had gone to Malaysia and they had applied for someone from Malaysia. It didn't pan out, and the girl from Thailand decided not to go. So I was on the kind of a waiting list, and then they told me that I got to go to Vancouver, Washington. So if that girl from Thailand hadn't backed out from her decision to come to the United States, I probably wouldn't have gotten to come here. Mm-hmm. So that was the thing that was, I felt that was the luckiest. The second piece of luck was when I came back the second time, there was a student that I had known, made friends with at the Evergreen High School, and he was in the Army, with the intelligence army in Germany. And he wrote me Christmas time and he said, well, Kim, try to get out of Vietnam because Vietnam was going to fall. And I didn't believe it. But I said, oh, this is a way to get back to America. So I wrote my American family and they said, come over. So I left in February, which is, so it's just 2 months.
February of what year?
Of 1975. So it was just 2 months before the takeover. So I never experienced all the drama that was going on after the fall of Saigon. So that was the second piece of luck. And then I think in a way with my American family to support me, and I happened to have a very, very nice family that helped me going through the hard times when I first came. They paid for my tuition. And at that time I was still technically an international student, so the tuition was very high. And I remember my mom paying $800 per term in 1975. That was a lot of money for my education. So not many people have families who are that generous, especially their host families, and they were only responsible for you for 1 year. But they were very generous.
That was lucky. And when you say your mom, you mean your American mom?
My American mom. Huh. And I still call her mom. So I have two families, one Vietnamese family and one American family. And I still, like at Dominic's birthday, my son's birthday, they come over. And I still call them brother and sister. And keep in touch with them for the last 30 years. This is a very long relationship.
So you came over here. And you were living here, but all of your family was still in Vietnam.
They were stuck in Vietnam, and a group of them, my sister, two sisters, and one of the older sisters' family had tried to escape by boat, and they left Vietnam in 79. And that was a group that came to the refugee camp, and then I sponsored them over here first. And then I sponsored the rest of the family from Vietnam directly. After my sister left, by boat, and she wrote back to my family, said, don't ever escape by boat again.
What happened
because
to her?
She was robbed about 30 times
by
on the ocean by Thai pirates, and she was, there were no more equipments left on the boat, so the boat was just floating for 20 some days in the ocean. and they almost die. In fact, at the toward the end, my two nephews, they were 6 and 8 at that time, 6 and 10 at that time. They had to drink urine in order to survive. So that was a pretty traumatic experience. And she said, she wrote back to my parents and said, never try to escape by boat. Just wait for Kim to do the paperwork for you to come.
And so that's what they did.
That's what they did.
And then
they
when were you able to bring them
1985.
Over?
You have to become a citizen first. It takes 5 years to become a citizen, and then it takes me another 5 years to get them out, which is a lot, which was a lot quicker than now. Than now, it could take up to 10, 15 years to get someone out of your country, of other countries.
When did you get married?
I got married in 1978.
And you met him here or in Vietnam?
I met my husband here.
And he was Vietnamese?
He was Vietnamese, and he was also by himself. He was in the Navy, so he escaped with the Navy boat by himself. He left the whole family behind. And both of us were working very hard to try to get our respective families out of Vietnam.
And in fact, you ended up bringing his
bringing his family because they also escaped by boat and ended up in France. They were picked up by the medical French boat called the Lumière, and they ended up in France. And the irony was my husband went to France to visit them because his father was almost killed in a car accident in France. He went over there to visit his father who survived, and then he came back to Portland, and then he died a couple months later from the accident.
Your husband was in an accident.
It was just a fishing. He fell off the river.
He fell out of the boat?
No, just off the fishing on Marine Drive. He was climbing out on those logs, and then I think he just fell into the river. So the father survived. The father was supposed to have died from the accident, but the father survived, and my husband came home and died 2 months later. But we kept the information away from my father-in-law so that he would come to the United States because my husband had done all the paperwork to sponsor them.
So then you went ahead and brought
everybody. I went ahead and brought 24 people.
And Dominic wasn't born.
Dominic, I found out after my husband passed away that I was 10 weeks pregnant, which my husband didn't even know about. So that was pretty tragic. But after Dominic was born, all of his family's here. And my sister's family was already here from the refugee camp. And then 5 years later, my own family came. The rest of the family came from Vietnam.
So you've been busy bringing people
bringing
here.
Bringing about 40 people all together. And then I also sponsor some of the foster children's family over here. Because when my family came, my parents came, we did foster care for a while, for Asian kids, for Vietnamese kids.
What was that like?
You know, because I was here by myself, and I knew it was so important to have a family, someone for you to, you know, to be with, and someone that you care for. So we decided to have foster children. These are the Vietnamese kids with no relatives to take care of. So it was very rewarding. We have different groups of siblings at different times, all together, about 15 kids. And then there was one sibling group that I sponsor his family over. They still live in Portland now.
And do you see these kids that you are foster mother
to?
We see
them all the time.
They all live in
Portland? They all live in Portland. We had 4 or 5 different sibling groups at different times. And many of them are married now and have kids, so they bring the kids over to see my mom.
So you've always been connected to kids, huh?
Always been connected with kids.
So you came to the United States and you had jobs. Tell us about your jobs here. What were they like? And
well, the first job was a social worker with the Indo-Chinese unaccompanied minors. Those are the kids I talked about who came here with no relatives. And I placed them with families, and we made sure that they get a good foster placement. They go to school and they graduate with a diploma, and then we emancipate them and they move on with either college or jobs. And so I was doing that for 7 years, and we had over 120 kids during that time.
You worked with how many?
My caseload was about 25.
And you worked at, for what agency?
Lutheran Family Service.
Tell us about that agency.
It was mainly a counseling agency, but they also sponsor refugees, and they do the unaccompanied minors program. And it's mainly a non-profit organization, and their mission is to help people. To help people grow in different ways in their own life, to help people find the spiritual, ideals that they're looking for, help people who are hurting, people who are in need, like the refugees, looking for jobs for them, making sure that they settle in the United States successfully.
And it didn't have anything to do with whether you were Lutheran or Buddhist or Catholic?
No, there was no, you don't have to, you have to believe in the mission, but you don't have to be religious.
So that was your first job. Then what did you do?
And then I decided to go back to school, and then I ran into a director of ESL at that time, John Weathers. I don't know if you recall him. And then he recruited me to work for Portland Public Schools. So I became a resource specialist, multicultural specialist for the ESL program. And basically my job was to do a lot of counseling with the kids, doing some case management with ESL kids. And when I first started, they were having a lot of problems with Amerasian children. These are the children.
Hang on just a minute. I need to change this. So you were, can we go back just a little
bit?
Because you worked at PCC. Did you do that before?
That was teaching. That was just a short time, about a year and a half.
But yeah. That was before?
Before I worked for
Portland Public Schools.
Yeah.
Okay. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah. My first job was working at Burger King. Before I was able to find anything, I was working at Burger King for about a month. And then I went to work at Sears in the credit department. And then I found a job teaching at PCC. They had an influx of Indo-Chinese refugees, so I taught the adults refugee. They were with the CETA program at that time. It's a federal program where you get training, you go to school, get the training, and get paid at the same time. So their first part of the training was 6 months to a year of ESL, and the second part would be job training. So my part was to teach ESL to the adult refugees.
And what was it like? What was that job like? Were you treated well? And
well, everything was going well until one of the women said to me, "I wanted to know if I can teach upper level ESL." And then she said that, "Kim, I feel more comfortable with you teaching the lower level." And I had mentioned it to another coworker, and she said, "Why? You have to ask her why. What was the reason why she doesn't feel comfortable with you teaching higher level?" So then I think we took it on to the next level, and then I met with a couple of people from HR.
What's
at PCC.
That?
That's human resources. And I think one of the deans of adult basic education met with me. And basically they said, because the co-worker is African-American woman, so they met with me. They said, "Oh, I think there's somebody behind you. Otherwise you wouldn't come to this far to make a complaint against the other woman." Because they said the other woman is well-intentioned. It was based on practicality, and it's not because she has any racial bias against me.
But you felt otherwise?
At that time, I was very young and I was very naive. But I expressed my thoughts, and I basically said that, I believe that I can do better. And I don't know exactly how it was resolved, but later on, I still see that African-American lady, and we still exchange emails and talk about the old days.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I've been here a lot longer, I can see the subtlety of the biases. At that time,
I was totally naive about how people perceive you. Perceptions can be very, very, you know, very, very dangerous, because if you perceive that you're not able to do the job, then people just kind of put you in a box. At that time, I didn't really quite see it that way. I was just afraid because I felt I was intimidated, but I didn't know quite how to put it into the way I describe it now.
But it sounds like you did stand up for yourself.
I met with them. I met with two people. One from the personnel department, and one was the dean.
And that was frightening?
It was very scary, because these people are high up top, and they just want kind of to put a stop to what I was planning to do, and they were afraid that I might go further than them. So I think that was the purpose of the meeting.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to hear that, so I didn't want us to lose that part of the story. But now I wanted you to go back to Lutheran Family Services and tell us about the Amerasian program.
We had a lot of Amerasian kids. These are the kids who whose GI soldiers had left behind, and then we sponsor them over. So I had developed some experience working with them. Many of them felt like they needed, America owed them something. So they came with a very arrogant attitude, and very demanding attitude. You know, they are Americans in Vietnam, and they should be privileged. They should be treated with special privileges. So they all came with that demanding attitude. And then they realized, especially some of them who are African-American, Amerasian kids, they found out really the hard way.
What did they find out?
They find out that it's not that way. In America wanted to forget the war, and they are really reminders of the war, so they weren't treated like if they were special guests to this country. They still have to go through the same things. And especially being a refugee, that's pretty low status. They still have to do things and pay their dues and work and go to school.
Do you think they experienced more prejudice than the regular?
When they were in Vietnam, definitely. They will experience a lot more prejudice. But over here, you know, I don't think people even pay attention or know who they are.
Yeah. So you went from that program, and then what did you do?
Portland Public Schools. Uh-huh. Because at that time, they had a lot of Amerasian in the school. So the director of ESL wanted to recruit me. And we basically started out as a social work counseling model that we are based at the different schools where the majority of Asian kids are. And you deal with them on that level. Run support groups. Make sure that they get along with their peers in school. Make sure that teachers understand them. Make sure that some of the perceptions about them are not prejudiced. Make sure that the school system, you are basically an advocate for them in that school setting.
Would you say that there was much prejudice of teachers against Southeast Asian kids?
I think most teachers are very well intentioned. And of course, you always run into some bad apples once in a while. But I think that most teachers welcome them. And even though some teachers might misunderstand the behaviors, but they started out with a very good intention. For example, the Amerasians, many of them are not educated. They, when Vietnam was taken over, they were kind of hidden away from sight because they were afraid of retaliation. So most of them don't have the same kind of parenting, kids who come from intact homes. So their behaviors are very, very difficult.
You started working with troubled kids pretty early on then.
That's all I've done all my life, except for the part about teaching. But ever since I started with Lutheran Family Service and up to now.
You've worked with the more troubled kids.
I work with the more troubled kids.
So you also work at Donald E. Long Home.
I work with the kids who are in trouble with the law at Donald D. Long Home, and my job is essentially make decisions when the kids are picked up for any criminal offenses, whether they go home or they stay at Donna D. Long.
And that's all kids, not just
Asian. That's all kids, yeah.
Though when you first started, they must have relied on you to take care of them.
Actually, it's very few Asian kids. Asian kids don't seem to be, I know that they commit crimes, but for some reason they haven't been, you know, in the system that much. They are just a few kids. The number is very, percentage is very, very limited.
The ones who were simply Amerasian or?
It's mixed.
Mixed.
Mixed and mostly car theft. Car theft.
Not much on Southeast Asian gang members?
Some of them are gang members.
What can you tell us about that?
Car theft is a way for them to support a drug habit. So stealing cars, selling cars in order to buy drugs, or that's how they got involved with the legal system.
Now, this is early on or now?
It's been pretty consistent.
Okay. So most of the crimes you've seen them commit have to do with cars and theft?
Car thefts and some burglaries, a few times assault with family members, families who have trouble with, raising children here in this country, and a few runaways, but we don't deal so much with runaways anymore.
Tell us about the families who had difficulty with their kids. Can you tell us why those problems occurred when they did?
When the parents come to this country, and if they are not equipped with the language, or with the cultures, oftentimes they're left behind. And there's a big gap between parents and kids. And kids, if the parents are not able to parent the kids or are not able to educate them and understand what they're going through, oftentimes the kids learn the wrong ways about the American ways of life, and they pick up the superficial culture, TV culture, materialistic culture, and it's all also because they want instant gratification, just like any teenager here. So they get into trouble with the law. A lot of thefts, too. So it's just, I think, and also there are a lot of kids who join the gangs because they want protection. They think that they discriminated against, so they join the gangs to get the protection that they need and to be someone. The third piece is to be someone. If you belong to a gang, it means something, and you can show to the world that you are somebody else. But if you don't belong, you don't belong to the mainstream culture, to the dominant culture, and you don't feel that you belong to your own culture, you don't have anything left. So that's the majority of it. But many of the kids, when it boils down to it, they are pretty decent kids.
That was definitely my experience.
Yeah.
The kids that I know have complained about discrimination in the schools against Southeast Asian kids. And not just from teachers, but from other kids. Do you think that has abated somewhat with time, or do you think it's still going on to some extent?
It's not just, I think it's not so much discrimination, but it's the way our system is set up that kids have to be assimilated. And kids, if they are familiar with the language, with the culture, then it's easier for them to be acculturated or assimilated. But if they're not, then you have a problem. And when you set yourself apart, it's very hard for teenagers to be different. And oftentimes the kids get teased, or there's a lot of racial baiting going on. There's still, you know, if you go into the cafeteria of any particular high school nowadays, you will see Russian kids, Asian kids, Hispanic kids, they all sit separately. And then you have the black kids and you have the white kids. So there's something about our institution that we haven't been able to blend them, or they haven't been able to help kids intermingle. And I think that we have to evaluate. But it's not an easy thing, because as a human person, you always hang around with who you're comfortable with. So, you know, that peace still remains the same. But in terms of kids, you know, acculturation, many kids can be acculturated, but it doesn't mean that they're comfortable. It's harder for them to hang around with groups that are different than them. So it's not that easy said, but not easy done.
How important do you think it is that kids come from families where Vietnamese is still spoken in the home and the cultural values of Vietnam are held?
For my family, either you acculturated, but, you know, it's like you, if you're in between, you're not really a good American citizen and you're not a good Vietnamese citizen. That's not good, because if you can be a good American citizen, I am perfectly happy with it. Or you can be a perfectly, you know, good Vietnamese citizen. Either way is good, but there are a lot of kids who haven't been able to do that. There are some kids that are more successful, they're able to blend both. That would probably be the best place to be. But either way is good. There's nothing bad about being totally Vietnamese or totally American. It's just how that they haven't been, they're marginal, and they cannot blend the two cultures. And that's when it becomes hard for them.
Do you mind if I ask your opinion about what's going on in the world today with our country, say, in Iraq? Mm-hmm. Do you see similarities between what we're doing in Iraq now with what we did in Vietnam years ago?
There's some similarities, but I wouldn't say completely, because with Vietnam, it was a lot more complex. We went into a country that we know nothing about. With Iraq, there was a purposeful, you know, there was an intended plan. And I think it was part of the 9/11 backlash that we decided to go into Iraq. And with the new president, with the Republican in office, we tend to be more aggressive with other countries. So I think there's some similarities, but I wouldn't say the two situations are the same.
You're dealing now with kids from that part of the world, right? Do you see similarities between those kids and the Vietnamese kids who came to this country in the 70s?
You mean the Iraq kids?
Yeah.
I don't have any experience with
you
the Iraq.
You haven't had
no.
any? Oh.
None of them have come to the school system that I know of.
Oh, yeah, there are some at Madison.
Are there some?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I just thought maybe you had dealt with some of them. No.
We've had Somalian, and we've had the people from Urdu, but nobody from Iraq.
So at Marshall.
At Marshall, yeah.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. Are there other things that you would like to talk about that you think are important for Americans to know about the Vietnamese people who live here today, the Vietnamese American people who live here today, things that maybe people should know?
I think that it doesn't matter how long that we live here, we will always be Vietnamese Americans. And maybe just allow us that uniqueness of being Vietnamese American. And we are acculturated. We've been here a long time too. So, but the most important thing to note is the contributions of Vietnamese Americans as well as any you know, Asian Americans or Iraqi Americans or whatever country where they came from, Americans. And I think that that's why we are so unique, because we are able to live a very unique life. And because of being here, that's why we be able to do that. So it's a both thing that I'm thankful for being here, to be able to be Vietnamese American, and also just to so that you are aware of the uniqueness of our position. So you don't say, oh, wow, you know, why would they behave that way? They already live in America. So there's asking for more of a flexibility and understanding that we are in a very unique position.
What are some of the important contributions you think Vietnamese people have made to this country, the Vietnamese Americans have made to this country?
Well, for one thing, politically, I think people are more conscious about the Vietnam War. So whatever political or war situation that they want to get into, they will always remember Vietnam. And there's so much talents. There's so many, the Vietnamese people have so many gifts and talents, partly because they came from such a war-torn countries that the talents weren't developed. So I think that's why you see a surge of Vietnamese Americans who are very talented and made major contribution, especially in politics, in social welfare, and in medical, in science, engineering, in
the
all
arts,
areas, the arts, all areas, yeah. All areas that you can see of, which is very, very surprising to me because these skills wouldn't have been able to been developed if they were still in Vietnam.
Even, so, but they would have been before the communists took over.
We wouldn't have the resources for these skills to be developed either, especially the arts, because the arts have always been neglected over there. They focus on the science, the medical, engineering, lawyers, but never the arts. So I see so much talents, and that and us now they combine the East and the West in the arts. Ming Tran, for example. And then when they do that play, the bilingual play downtown, Shakespeare, A Midsummer Night Dream, that was wonderful. I was able to see that. So I think it's a lot of amazing talents that we weren't able to develop. And there are a lot of people with skills, computer skills, you know, chemical skills, people with inventions. And I think that we contributed to the entrepreneurship. Very, very, very business-minded people. And we are able to, because we are all over the whole world. And every country that have Vietnamese refugees settling there, there are always success stories. Whether it's business, medical, you know, science, electronics, engineering, food industries, they're always success stories.
Are you getting tired?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. You said something that I wanted you to talk further about it. Now I can't remember what it was. Maybe I want you to go back a little bit. What do you think about your upbringing prepared you to, I mean, you talked about luck, you talked about perseverance. What in the way your parents raised you, what about your own culture helped prepare you for what you have gone through since you've been here? Because, I mean, you've brought a lot of people here. You've been responsible for a lot of people. You've raised your son by yourself.
Well, one of the things that is important for me is to have a family, the stability of a family. And, you know, with my father, I always know that I was very lucky to have such a dedicated father. I was a little bit less respectful of my mom, and I didn't really understand her role in terms of helping the family succeed. She was a homemaker all her life. And when I grew up in Vietnam, I always thought of the country as being sexist. And my father was a role model. He said, it doesn't matter whether you are a boy or a girl. I want you to succeed in your education. So that was one of the inspiration that I got from my father. And I think the cultural piece for me is that you don't take life for granted, number one. And you always have respect for the elderly, for the past, because the past connects with the present and the future. If someone does something for you, you need to remember that. And the relationship between people is a lot more important than, the individual aspect of yourself. So we have always taught that it's not a privilege. I mean, it's not a right that you were born with. It's everything you get, it's a privilege, and you have to earn it. So to pay back is one of the obligations.
To take care of the elderly is another one, and to take care of your family. So all these things combined, I think, help make a person very strong.
I've heard some people talk about that, the agreement, kind of unspoken agreement, that you take care of your parents, and that is changing a little bit because people are working and they really don't have time mm-hmm. anymore to follow those old traditions. Have you seen evidence of that, and what do you think about that?
Yeah, it's happening, but even with that, they're trying to meet the needs of the elderly. For example, here in Portland, we have a couple foster homes just geared for Vietnamese elderly folks, and then we have groups of people who are setting up places where they can be hanging out together, like the Vietnamese Senior Service Center in Hollywood. So I think they are responding to situations where people cannot take care of the elderly. But just like also what's happening with the Chinese, they build the center in Northwest Portland for the Chinese senior citizens. So I think the Vietnamese people are also learning how to respond to the changing environment. But we always try to keep the elderly as home as possible, as long as they can take care of themselves. So I think that part, like just with my mom, if something happens to her that she cannot take care of herself, then one of us will have to stay home. And my sister-in-law will probably stay home and take care of her. So it's something that we cannot give up yet.
Maybe that's a really wonderful thing.
Yeah.
a lot of the people I've interviewed have been educated people. And so it's making it seem that everyone has been as successful as you have been, and that all Vietnamese are well-educated. And, of course, we know that is not true.
Sure.
It's a myth, really an American myth. What could you tell us about that? What do you have to say that would help us understand that the situation of less fortunate Vietnamese Americans?
Well, in 75, you and I both know that we all had a saying, if you put an Asian kid in the closet, they would do well. But it has changed a lot. I have parents who don't even know the name of the school. They don't know the location of the school. And they just say, oh, that's where my son goes to school, but they cannot really tell anything beyond that. So we have parents who work a couple jobs to even make ends meet. We have parents who are divorced. We have parents, we have domestic violence. We have child abuse. I'm at JDH, so sometimes I run into Vietnamese families where kids are taken from the home. So we run into a whole host of problems, social problems, just like any other American family. And then the sad part for these families is that they are not familiar with the language or how to navigate the system and how to get help. So that in a way, they're in worse shape than an average American family. And then especially when parents whose children got into the legal system, then it's even scarier. Because they don't know how. We have a couple parents now whose kids are committing Measure 11 offenses. And they don't understand what Measure 11 is. And they don't understand how to help the kids in the legal system. So we do have a lot of social problems, just like other people. But what is more difficult for our parents and our community is that they don't have the help that they need. They don't know how to access the help that they need.
So the help,
even if they go to the agencies, there needs to be someone who can help them understand the two systems and explain to them how to get the help.
So the help is there, you're saying. It's just that they don't know how to access it?
But also the agencies that serve mainly mainstream, they don't know how to help people with difficult, language barrier or cultural barriers.
Okay.
So the help is limited.
and the problem getting more is limited. Worse, right?
Getting more limited. Yeah. We do have a few things. The Asian Family Center, ERCO, the refugee program at the medical school for mental disability patients. But it's pretty limited.
Are there enough interpreters out there?
In the schools, we have bilingual assistants. And then in some of the social service agencies, they try to hire bilingual, as many bilingual as possible. The county is also trying to do that. But it's always limited. And also, you know, it's so diverse. We have a lot of diverse people living in Portland.
So it's hard to know how many interpreters of which language groups. What are your plans for the future? Your own personal plans?
Oh, you know, just living an ordinary life is hard. Just like anybody else trying to get your retirement in place. And I basically just work with my family, making sure that they're okay, and get a decent pension, and then go back to Vietnam to visit again.
Have you been back to Vietnam?
Just once.
And what was your experience?
I wasn't back for almost 20-some years, 24, 25 years, so it was very different. Very hot, humid, and...
Did you have a lot of family there?
I still have aunts and uncles and cousins.
And what was it like seeing them?
That they were very happy to see me, and I was happy to see them. But the people are different because they live with the communists for so long. There's changes in
how,
the way
how
they
are
look.
They different?
It's not as peaceful as it used to be, and I think your life is a lot more competitive, and you have to be worried about the security. It's really not there completely like it used to be. Yeah, they have to worry about changes in the government, worry about changes in the currency, and whether they can still do the same business, you know, a few years from now. So basically they have to live very fast and for today.
Well, I don't know. How long have we been going here? 58 minutes. I think there was one other question I had. Oh, Dominic.
Yeah.
Your son has just graduated from...
Yes, finally, from Portland State with a degree in geography. I think they do mapping on the computers. GIS.
And what are his plans?
He's hoping to go back to Vietnam because he's never been to Vietnam. He was born here. And I really wanted him to because I think if he goes back to Vietnam, he would have a better sense of appreciation of what he has. And to find his roots, to know what really it is that we've been talking all along about Vietnam, some of the cultural values, and for him just to see in general where he came from.
And then what do you think he'll be doing?
He would like to teach, if it's possible. He wants to teach ESL.
In Vietnam?
In Vietnam.
And what do you feel about that?
I would be happy for him to do that. I think he would grow up a lot. It would help him gain his maturity after he sees. And, you know, life in Vietnam is not that easy in terms of you have to compete and you have to learn how to navigate the system with the communist government. So he's going to learn to deal with many things that he hasn't learned how to do with it here. So I think he will grow up a lot more, faster. But I have always have a lot of confidence in Dominic because... he's a sharp young man, and he can take care of himself, so I don't worry about it at all.
Kind of like his mom.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kim.